Penguin Random House Audio presents Robert B. Parker's Broken Trust by Mike Lupica. Read for you by Joe Montaigne. This book is for my friend James Patterson. Chapter 1. I was sitting at my desk drinking my third cup of coffee of the morning. I was doing this guilt-free, having read that 2 to 5 cups a day not only prevented a long list of diseases, but also helped you live a longer, if more caffeinated, life. But then you can always find somewhere on the internet that tells you what you want to hear about almost anything. I was certain that if I looked long enough, I could find a site promising a reasonably priced way for me to look like Bradley Cooper. By now, I had already made short work of the second Boston cream I'd picked up at the Dunkin' just down Boylston from my office, the one near the public library. 2 blocks down, 2 blocks back. But I had walked briskly, telling myself it was exercise, even if the prize had been the donuts, which didn't extend your life, just made it more worth living. Dunkin' Donuts had long since rebranded and was just calling itself Dunkin' now. I had considered doing something similar, but knew it was too late for that. And when it came to branding yourself with just one name, I had frankly been way ahead of the game. Carol Sloan's voice was coming out of the tiny speaker near the Keurig machine, and I was methodically making my way through the print edition of the Globe, as I still did every morning, front to back, section by section, saving sports for last. The man who owned the Globe also owned the Red Sox. The paper was having a far better September than his baseball team was. But then, just about everybody was. It had reached the point where I was no longer certain that the two guys who were supposed to be our top starting pitchers were actually still right-handed. "Maybe you should think about finding a new hobby," Hawk had said the other day, after listening to me bitching again about the local 9. "I've got too much time invested in them," I said. "It's the same reason I'm still with you." "You with me," Hawk said, "because I don't have no bad years." We had just finished moving the last of my furniture that we could carry ourselves into my new apartment, which just happened to be a few doors down from the one I'd been burned out of a few years ago. It was the event that had prompted my move away from Marlborough Street and all the way to the Charleston Navy Yard. At the time, Susan Silverman, trying to mitigate my loss, had said that while it had been the equivalent of a forced eviction, it might have been time for a change, even though she knew better than anyone that I liked change about as much as I liked TikTok. "Most people do move sooner or later," Susan said. "The Red Sox haven't," I said. She had promised that I would embrace the new place once I was in it and proceeded to move in and decorate it like an invading ground force. And eventually, I had grown both fond and familiar with my new surroundings, the neighborhood, the proximity to the Navy Yard, even the younger vibe over there, as if I were the one who was young and had moved to Boston all over again. But recently, I'd done some work for a man named Kevin Bowles, who owned great big chunks of property in Back Bay, getting Bold's son out of a jam with Tony Marcus that involved substantial gambling losses that Tony had decided required more than just money in payment. Tony wanted real estate favors from Kevin Bold's, specifically involving a particular building he hoped to use for a new escort service on Charles Street now that COVID was over and the sex trade was booming again. Bold's had come to me and I had gone to Tony, reminding him that he owed me a favor. Tony told me that he didn't owe me shit and get the fuck out of his office. But being as transactional as he'd always been, an accommodation had been reached and he got the building he wanted. Kevin Bowles considered it a small price to pay to get his son clear of Tony, and even after he generously settled up with me, he said that he was the one who now owed me a favor. About a week later, he'd called and told me that an apartment on Marlborough near the corner of Arlington had opened up, having remembered me mentioning that I'd lived on the same part of that street before what I called the Great Boston Fire. Bowles said that the apartment hadn't yet gone on the market and asked if I might be interested in moving back to the old neighborhood. I surprised myself at how quickly I said that I was. He said he could give me a break on the rent. I told him that wasn't necessary. He insisted. A month away from the end of my lease in Charlestown, I signed the lease that day, put down a deposit, and just like that, Daddy was home. "Do you know how much I've missed walking to work?" I said to Susan the first time we stepped into the empty apartment. At this point, people in outer space know that. She asked me just how much Kevin Bowles had paid for my services and how much of a break he was giving me on the rent. I told her, at which point she had smiled wickedly. Susan has a lot of smiles, most of which make me feel lightheaded and oxygen-deprived when directed at me. This one, I knew from experience, was going to cost me money. "I know that look," I said. "What look is that?" she asked innocently. "The one where you can't wait for the stores to open." She kissed me then and said, "Don't you worry your pretty little head about it." The new apartment, about the same size as the old one, didn't actually feel like home yet, but I was getting there. Pearl the Wonder Dog had already settled in quite nicely when she and Susan would be there for sleepovers. Pearl hadn't come right out and said how much she liked it that she could walk to work with me, too, when Susan would leave her with me. It was more something I had intuited. Now I just needed work, as there hadn't been any since I'd saved Kevin Bold's son. "If you can walk to work, but there ain't no work," Hawk had said, "answer me something. What's the fucking point?" I was pondering that and whether I should walk back down to Dunkin' for more donuts before I got too close to lunch, when there was a knock on my door and the wife of the sixth richest man in America came walking in. Chapter 2. Laura Crane was a friend of Susan's from a couple charity boards they both served on in Boston, one of which, the Jimmy Fund, was as famous a charity as there was in the city, aligned with the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and deeply connected to the Red Sox all the way back to when Ted Williams had first gotten involved. Susan and Laura Crane shared a Pure Bar class a couple times a week and would meet occasionally for lunch. I knew that Susan liked her very much, as rich and famous as Laura and her husband were, and not just in Boston. Laura had met Andrew Crane when they were both students at Harvard. Laura was an English major. He was a full-fledged, card-carrying Division of Science nerd, along with his best friend, Ethan Lowe. I knew the general outline of their shared biography because by now most people in America knew it. 5 years after Lowe and Andrew Crane graduated, working out of a small rented lab in Dorchester, they'd invented a synthetic form of lithium that had reimagined the world of batteries forever. Susan had mentioned in passing a few weeks earlier that I might be hearing from her friend Laura about a problem she was having, one she'd shared in confidence with Susan. "Are you treating her now?" "Not professionally, just hearing her out as a friend and offering advice when she's asked for it."
"And she has a problem that you can't solve?" I said. "What is it, the melting of the ice caps?"
"She'll tell you when the two of you meet," Susan said, "if she doesn't lose her nerve."
"Couldn't she buy some nerve?" I'd asked. "I assume she can afford it."
"Let's just wait and see," Susan said. "She should be the one to tell you what's happening in her life, but I told her that if anybody could help her, it's my cutie."
Now Laura Crane sat across my desk from me. Tall. Honey-colored hair hanging to her shoulders. Blazer, white jeans that fit her the way God intended jeans to fit women with legs as long as hers. Ankle boots. Whatever her actual age was, I had already decided she looked younger. She reminded me of a slightly younger version of Julia Roberts, not that I would ever say that to Julia. A knockout by any measure. It was something I knew I couldn't verbalize without sounding as if I were objectifying her and being on my way to Weinstein Island. But Andrew Crane, I could see, hadn't just gotten
Sample complete. Ready to continue?